This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yais Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight:
in spite of the drought, in spite of the shortages, the government has worked with other hard-working Kenyans, farmers, traders, to ensure that the country is food secure and to continue being food secure.
That's Kenyan government spokesman Eric Kirati talking about the drought situation in the country. Details coming up.
Also, reports indicate that a bomb blast has killed at least 8 people in Mogadishu, and cholera outbreaks in East Africa and Yemen are compounding what is already a major humanitarian crisis.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on African News Tonight. Our top story: VOA Somali service reports that a bomb blast has killed at least 8 people and left others wounded in Mogadishu. The explosives were hidden in a car near Wabira police station, which is on the busy road of Maka al-Mukarma. VOA reporter Ahmed Hassan Aulud, who was at a nearby building, said he saw a man driving a Toyota Surf SUV speeding to the police station. An emergency team is working to help the wounded.
The International Federation of the Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies, IFRC, warns cholera outbreaks in East Africa and Yemen are compounding what is already a major humanitarian crisis. Somalia, South Sudan, and Yemen are now grappling with escalating cholera outbreaks. They've infected more than 220,000 people and killed nearly 2,100 since the beginning of 2017. IFRC Secretary General Elhad Assi explains how a complex cycle of circumstances led to the cholera epidemic and how it continues to spread throughout the region.
First of all, we need to understand that people who are living in humanitarian settings like in South Sudan, Yemen, and Somalia, they face multiple deprivations. Those multiple deprivations are better known when it reaches, you know, the level of famine. Unfortunately, by the time, it is a little bit too late. You know, these classification phases are named at a level 2, a stress. A level 3 is a crisis. A level 4 is an emergency. And it is only the level 5, you know, that is called the famine. By the time we get to level 5, of course, people are confronted with a lot of hardship. And when we get to level 5, and there's a too much concentration and focus, you know, on the famine, but we realize that the excess mortality during the time is due to other causes of illness. Now, the evidence between malnutrition and famine and death, there is illness. And those illnesses are mainly measles, they are mainly also cholera. And cholera is now taking a toll in that region, really exacerbating the humanitarian situation. In the Horn of Africa and then including also Yemen, we are talking about hundreds of thousands of cases of cholera and thousands of lives that are already, you know, lost. Now, specifically in Yemen, in the last 7 weeks, we are talking about roughly 135,000 cholera cases, and that is nearly a daily caseload of 5,000 cases, and that is huge. Since the beginning of the year in Somalia, we've registered 48,000 cases of cholera. We should not lose sight of the other conditions that are causing the excess mortality during famine. And those are preventable diseases. Those are curable diseases. And we can really do something about it, provided that the space is safe and access is guaranteed, and then the funding follows.
You have said, to quote you, it is the most vicious of vicious spirals, and the situation is rapidly escalating downwards and out of control. So in all three of those countries, these trigger factors, are they the same for all the countries?
Yeah, they have definitely some common trigger factors, which is the conflict. We cannot always blame it, you know, to the rain or blame it to drought. It is about the lack of enabling environment for effective response. Safety and security of civilians, healthcare workers and health facilities sometimes being even targeted. All that now combined, you know, with the drought, you know, leads to this kind of a situation. Water sanitation and hygiene in particular is critical in all those elements, they also suffer from the same bottlenecks.
And you have people there on the ground just working very vigorously to try to control this. What is the best way to control this type of an outbreak?
Good water sanitation and hygiene facilities, sewage management, looking at water points that are safe, but also storage of water, you know, at home. All these, you know, contribute heavily, you know, to it. Simple habits, you know, like hand washing and having the facilities, you know, to do that, contributing to very significantly containing this kind of outbreak.
What do you see in the months ahead for these countries?
Unfortunately, not very, very, very optimistic. While we, on the one hand, appreciate everything which is being done and every action which is being undertaken, and a lot is being undertaken indeed, will be contributing into saving lives. But we are still then experiencing constraints in access, and we're still suffering from lack of funding. You know, in some instances, you know, they're at best, you know, 20-25% covered, at worst, barely 10%. So we are not seeing an end to the conflict. Then, of course, we fear that not only will we not contain it, but we can even fear that when we access some other regions, and then particularly the remote places where they are the hardest to reach population and people in greatest need, we may even discover, you know, a picture that is bleaker than what we are experiencing today.
That was IFRC Secretary General El-Hajj Assi. He spoke with me from Geneva.
For over a decade now, Ugandans have been grappling with the succession talk. President Yoweri Museveni has been in power since 1986, and some Ugandans fear that he may want to handpick a successor by the end of his term in 2021. Speculation about the president's plans are rife within the ruling National Resistance Movement, NRM, and the main opposition Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC. Godbert Tumushabi is a political analyst and associate director of the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies. He spoke with reporter Halima Atumani about whether Ugandans should be discussing President Museveni's successor.
I think it is perfect or okay for a political party like FDC, like NRM, to say we are dealing with a transition if they choose to run their parties as a monarchy. But for Uganda, which is not a monarchy, we are talking about a transition. And in the case of Uganda, the debate becomes inevitable because President Museveni is ineligible to contest for another term of office because he already have clocked the age limit by the time he completes his term of office in 2021. So the debate about transition and how to ensure a peaceful transition from Museveni to another president becomes inevitable by operation of law.
So you're insisting on using the word transition and not succession.
Absolutely.
I think the reason why Ugandans keep talking about succession is the fact that we've heard about the Muhoozi project, a son of the president. We've also had some reports that maybe the first lady would also want to be a president of Uganda. So for them, it is a family affair. Should we then not be discussing that on that basis?
Yeah, but you see, they cannot set the debate, and we follow it and they become the beneficiary. That's why we are saying whether it is Muhoozi, whether it is Janet, whether it is someone else, it is still a transition from Seven to another president by applying our law. So I think people like Muhoozi and Kataha are all eligible to contest as presidents of Uganda. What happens within their parties on how they win the flag of their parties could be a succession debate. But I don't think that debate applies to Uganda as a country.
The reason why Ugandans are having this succession talk and not necessarily transition talk is that we have a president who has been in power for the last 31 years. I think 2021 he will be making 35 years.
Yes.
And there is fear that maybe he will not be able to relinquish power peacefully. Should we have that fear?
The fear should be there if we think we are incapable as citizens to be able to demand that every leader follows the law. But I think that Ugandans have reached a certain level of civic maturity that they appreciate that they have the power to shape and change the circumstances around them. And I think that that was evident in the last elections where people went out and voted and they knew their votes had been stolen, and you could see that the dead silence was really a form of protest. So I think we should be concerned how the transition process is managed, where people like President Museveni and other leaders a guaranteed, secure, and dignified retirement. And I think that should be, for me, the bottom line.
Right now, we're hearing talk about possible change in the constitution, which has started with our civil servants trying to amend the constitution so that they can increase their age and stay in their offices. And maybe eventually it will end up with the president extending his stay.
I think that there is a possibility that President Museveni may just catch the curse of other Africa's strong men and actually lack the courage to follow the law and therefore work to manipulate and maneuver the constitution and remove age limits. I think that cannot be ruled out, but it is our responsibility as Ugandans to actually challenge him and challenge all our leaders and actually increase the risks for them to do things that have essentially moved other countries to the brink of war. Yeah, because short of a peaceful transition of power from Museveni to another leader, and that leader could be in NRM, could be in any other party. Short of that, the possibility of violent and armed resistance become inevitable, because you see, the history of Uganda is such that almost every other government has tried to suffocate and kill the opposition. The consequence is that opposition normally emerges from within the ruling clique, or Ugandans take the option of armed resistance.
You've mentioned opposition coming from within parties. We've seen this in the NRM. And somehow we have seen people who have come up being forced to go silent. Do you think Ugandans have an option, not just within the NRM, but also in the opposition?
My take on this is to say that right now where we are, I don't think that we have a ruling party, nor do we have opposition political parties, because all these are broken pieces. And I believe that the biggest opposition to the current regime is not in organized political parties. The biggest opposition is actually in NRM. It is within the public service sector. It is within the civil society. It is within the citizenry.
That was Godbert Tumushabi, political analyst and associate director of the Great Lakes Institute for Strategic Studies. He spoke with reporter Halima Atumani from Kampala, Uganda.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15, 580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
I'm Yehi Suhib. 18 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Reports indicate that a bomb blast has killed at least 8 people in Mogadishu, and cholera outbreaks in East Africa and Yemen are compounding what is already a major humanitarian crisis. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com.
Well, Kenya says it has taken a number of measures to address a severe drought and serious food shortages affecting millions of people across the country. This as aid agencies continue to warn of a worsening situation in the Horn of Africa region. From Nairobi, Ruben Chama reports.
The Kenya Red Cross says up to 2.7 million Kenyans face starvation. In response, President Uhuru Kenyatta has declared the drought a national disaster. Government spokesman Eric Kiraithe says authorities have devoted millions of dollars aimed at tackling hunger.
In spite of the drought, in spite of the shortages, the government has worked with other hard-working Kenyans, farmers, traders, to ensure that the country is food secure and to continue being food secure. For the low-income earners, the measures which have been put in place have made the food available.
Those measures include subsidies on maize flour and the importation of 13,000 tons of the commodity from neighboring Ethiopia. According to the United Nations Humanitarian Agency, OCHA, some 26.7 million people across the Horn of African countries, including Kenya, Ethiopia, Somalia, and South Sudan, are experiencing severe drought and food shortages. The hunger crisis has been exacerbated by the impact of climate change. Kiraithe says the government is actively involved in engaging smallholder farmers to come up with sustainable solutions.
Sensitization on the need to be part of managing the environment, choosing drought-resistant crops for food security, to ensure that the current obsession with maize, which is a very demanding crop, as opposed to something like cassava, which is actually nutritionally much more richer, and other traditional crops, which would do wonders with the current advancement in crop husbandry. The issue of now converting land previously utilized for other purposes like Igalana, Kulalu, to food production, because the issue of population increase is also there.
The Galana Kulalu Food Security Project is an innovative irrigation effort on the Kenyan coast that's spearheaded by the government. The 400,000-acre project adjacent to the Galana River is aimed at transforming agricultural production in the country through large-scale irrigation systems, particularly for maize. Food scientists attribute fluctuating and often extreme weather patterns to climate change. In response, many urge national government to support the Paris Climate Accord, which encourages government to set goals for reducing carbon and other pollutants into the atmosphere. Kenya has released a plan called the Nationally Determined Contribution that would reduce greenhouse gas emissions by 30% over the next 13 years. It would also encourage agriculture and other sectors to adapt to climate change with improved technologies. In contrast, the US government recently announced it would leave the Paris Climate Change Accord. Kiraitha says it's a move that his government respects, though Nairobi is following another approach.
What do we think about American pullout? We respect America as a sovereign state, but as a government, we actually think that environmental changes is a global issue. We would be better working on this together, the priority for national interests notwithstanding.
He says the American authorities, like those in any democracy, are responding to climate change with policies that are supported by voters. Ruben Chama, VOA News, Nairobi.
A recent study by the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace calls for greater regional security, especially given the growing mobility of violent extremists and conflicts. Anwar Bukhar is a scholar in the Carnegie Middle East Program and the author of the study. He spoke to VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi about some of the most important countries involved in regional security.
There's Morocco, Algeria, Chad, and Nigeria. Nigeria and Algeria are major powers, but they have performed well below their potential. Chad is a single-dimensional military power that punches well above its weight. I mean, despite significant governance and developmental deficits, we have seen in the last years that Chad has emerged as a critical player in the fight against violent extremism. But out of the four powers, Morocco has demonstrated the centrality of soft power as a complement to hard power, you know, to tackle violent extremism, and that's quite innovative.
Nigeria in particular is infested with violent extremist groups like Boko Haram. How different would Nigeria's role be in the regional security cooperation?
Nigeria, by virtue of its large population, its strategic geographic location, its natural resource endowment, you know, its cultural outreach, has considerable potential to play an important role in West Africa and beyond. But unfortunately, when we look at Nigeria today, it's hard not to be underwhelmed by its power projection, you know, ability. That said, Nigeria's problems, domestic problems, do not condemn it to irrelevance. You know, although it took a hard hit from the recent fall in oil prices, Nigeria has the largest economy in Africa. This is before South Africa returned to the top slot recently. Nigeria's economy accounts for more than 70% of the collective GDP of West Africa. Nigeria functions as the mainspring of ECOWAS, the Economic Community of West African States. You know, it contributes 60% of its operating budget. So despite its woes, Nigeria retains significant potential, you know, to play an important role. Despite the problems that Nigeria struggles with, the country remains, as I said, an important player in regional security.
Do you envision any role for the U.S.-Africa Command in helping these countries in countering violent extremism?
The United States, I mean, you know, through AFRICOM, has been playing a role, as you know, U.S. drones are deployed throughout, and we have seen that in the creation of the G5. We have seen that the United States, and to a lesser extent the United States, has been, friends in the United States, have been supportive of that endeavor. So the ability to try to prop up the capacity of weak states, because the region is plagued by so many weak states. So the theory is if you prop up their capability, if you provide logistics and intelligence, I mean, obviously that would allow these countries like Mauritania, like Niger, like Burkina Faso, like Chad, to tackle these challenges. So yes, the U.S. has a role, and it has been playing an important role in the continent.
That was Anwar Bukhara, scholar in the Carnegie's Middle East program. He was speaking with VOA's Mohammed El-Shenawi.
Reuters says South Africa's High Court has ruled that secret ballots may be used in parliamentary votes of no confidence against the government. Critics say the decision could make it easier for members of the ruling African National Congress to cast votes against President Jacob Zuma. The president has survived 4 no-confidence votes over the past 8 years. Chief Justice Magoeng Magoeng said the Speaker of the National Assembly should consider the good of the country and not the party when deciding whether or not to use a secret ballot. He said such a vote should not be, as he put it, a fear or money-inspired sham. Last month, President Zuma defeated a no-confidence vote against him within his own party.
Authorities in Belgium said today police have detained 4 people in connection with the investigation into the foiled bomb attack at a Brussels train station. The Federal Prosecutor's Office said the detentions were a part of raids in Brussels, including in the Molenbeek neighborhood. There were no details about how the 4 people might be linked to the attack. The suspect in Tuesday's attack has been identified as a 36-year-old Moroccan native with the initials OZ, who may have supported the Islamic State militant group. Chemicals and other materials that can be used to make explosives were found in his home. The device, hidden in a suitcase, failed to fully detonate and did not injure anyone. The suspected attacker was shot and killed after a confrontation with police. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Curtis Bynum, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, I'm Douglas Simpoga. Join me for Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll take an in-depth look at an African news topic important to you. We'll have African journalists and expert guests share their ideas on the topic at hand. So, please plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on The Voice of America.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.